Hello, I'm your host, George Sanders, and this is Humanity Matters Most. Here, we explore behind the scenes of research being conducted at the University of Houston College of Liberal Arts and Social Sciences. This episode, we're taking a break from our podcast to feature another from the Center of Public History. Check out their podcast, Public Historians at Work, where they explore how historians leverage the past outside of the university as artists, activists, and community members to help make the world a better place. Season 3 of their podcast is dedicated to highlighting the innovative public-facing projects of UH faculty, students, and staff. Check out the archive to hear more student research and written shows, including their new series, Immigrant Stories, which investigates the diverse peoples that have made Houston their home.
Welcome to Public Historians at Work, a podcast of the Center for Public History at the University of Houston. I'm Dr. Mark Goldberg, Associate Professor of History and Interim Director of CPH. In this podcast series, we speak with academics, practitioners, activists, and community members about what it means to do history and humanities work for and with the public. In our third season, we're highlighting the innovative public history projects of the University of Houston and the creative faculty, staff, and students behind them. For more resources on these topics and ways to support the mission of CPH, make sure to check us out at uh.edu/class/CPH or find us on social media at UHCPHistory. Together, we can help reclaim our past.
In spring 2022, Dr. Mark Goldberg decided to try something new with his undergraduate history course. As a way of enriching his students' engagement with Jewish Latinx culture, Goldberg partnered with Holocaust Museum Houston to guide his class through the recording and archiving of 6 interviews with members of this community. A year later, on November 28, 2023, Goldberg sat down with one of his undergrads, Miranda Ruzinski, to reflect on the intellectual and personal impact of their participation in the Sephardic Latinx Oral History Project. Their conversation demonstrates how revelatory an experience practicing public history can be for undergraduates, from learning how to actively listen when conducting an oral history, to being part of building an archive of a hidden community, to collectively presenting these living stories to a public audience. Let's listen in.
Hey, Dr. Goldberg. Nice to see you again after class today.
Hey, Miranda. It's good to see you too. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Miranda Ruzinski. I am a senior at the University of Houston. I will be graduating in fall 2023 very soon this December. I will be continuing my research with history as a grad student at the University of Houston, getting my MA in public history with a focus on the Hispanic population in the United States.
I'm Mark Goldberg. I am an associate professor of history at the University of Houston and currently the director of the Center for Public History. My research and teaching focuses on U.S. Latinx history and immigration. And I have been teaching at the university for almost 13 years. And I'm looking forward to talking about our work on the Sephardic Latinx Oral History Project.
So can you tell the audience a little bit about the project and the certain parts of it? Because there were several parts.
Sure. So the Sephardic Latinx Oral History Project was partnered between UH undergraduate students and Holocaust Museum Houston, where 6 groups of students interviewed 6 Sephardic Latin American immigrants to the United States. The project was housed in a course that I had created and taught once before in 2017, and it's a U.S. Latina, Latino, Jewish history course. And the course comes out of my own research on this history. And the first time I taught it, it was a traditional history course with primary source and secondary source discussions, traditional essay writing. The 2 things that changed since then were, first, I taught oral history to graduate students. And second, I engaged in more public history work. And so I wanted to teach this class as an oral history course. And I come from the Latin American Jewish community in Houston, so it seemed natural to tap into my own community to start the project. A key element, of course, of public history work is working with communities to engage history. That meant two things for this project. One, in terms of interviewing actual community members, and two, it also meant partnering with Holocaust Museum Houston on this project. And I had been working with them for a few years on various kinds of Latinx-themed programming. And so when I started to develop the course and work with an institution at the University of Houston that supports co-curricular education and funds it, it became clear that it would make sense to partner with Holocaust Museum Houston. And so when I approached them as a potential archive for these interviews, since an oral history interview only becomes oral history once it enters the archive, the museum seemed like a natural partner. And when I started conversations with first Michelle Tovard and then Lori Garcia at the museum, they developed this focus on Sephardic history. And so I was thinking about Latinx Jewish history broadly, including Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews. And the museum is making an effort to focus on Sephardic stories, which in the grand scheme of Jewish historical storytelling is more on the margins than Ashkenazi stories. And so that partnership began, and I thought oral histories and public history are both incredible ways to teach history. So once that came to be and the co-curricular office supported the project and the course, I decided to transform this into an oral history course. After a semester of studying Jewish Latinx history and oral history and practicing the techniques and methods and theory of oral history, the students conducted these interviews, which are now archived on the Holocaust Museum Houston webpage. This first phase of the project culminated in a panel event where we celebrated the opening of the archive, the digital archive, to the community at this panel held at Holocaust Museum Houston, in which student interviewers and two Sephardic Latinx interviewees talked about their experiences participating in the project. So that was a long introduction, but it seems natural now to get the student perspective on the early stage of the project.
Yeah, so I was part of this class. I signed up for it in spring of 2022. And I signed up because I come from the Jewish community, but I come from strictly Ashkenazi descent, which is mostly Eastern European. And my mother is Hispanic. So she converted to Judaism when she married my father, but she comes from a Catholic background. So that is where my Hispanic heritage comes in. So I don't historically have ties to the Latinx Jewish community, but my whole life I have existed in a bicultural atmosphere in the way that both my parents' families have interacted, in the way they have designed our household dynamic. I grew up in a kosher household, but around my Hispanic grandparents, so it was very interesting. So I was drawn to this course, and when I found out that we were working with the Holocaust Museum of Houston, I was like, yes, I've been there before, like it's a great place. And then as class started to go on, because we didn't really start the oral history projects until halfway through, really, because we had training to do, and then of course there's the background history. But I learned there's so much more to the story of Sephardic Judaism here in the U.S., and especially its history in Latin America, which made its way obviously north to the U.S. And then I look around at a lot of my classmates, and UH has a large Hispanic population, a large Latinx population, and a lot of the students came from a Latinx background. And so my guess was they were drawn to this class like I was, because they identified with at least one of the characteristics that makes up this very niche population of people, which is both Latinx and Jewish. So they could probably relate to some of the food. We talked about food and how we can see the mixture of Jewish heritage and Latinx heritage in food, right? So we had people who'd be like, yeah, I know that food, or yeah, I know that music. This class really expanded my knowledge of the richness and the diversity, and really of the untold stories that are just treasure troves that I'm sure there's millions more. And so I was just really grateful that Dr. Goldberg gave us a chance to do this.
I have to say, I'm so pleased to hear several things you said, because one of the hardest things I would say about teaching oral history, especially when it's centered around a hidden history, which by definition means that most people aren't familiar with it, it's like, how do you teach enough of the background in order to prepare students to conduct these interviews? And we really only did background history for like 2 to 3 weeks. But the way you described it shows that, you know, the preparation for the interviews, and also understanding the impact of studying, how you put it, an untold story, that it landed, which is, you know, what any instructor wants to hear. So one thing I should mention about the beginning of class is when the semester started, there were 18 students enrolled in the class. That is very serendipitous in Jewish terms, because 18 is a significant number in Judaism, because it corresponds with the Jewish word chai, which means life. So we started with 18 students, which was determining how many interviewees to get, which then was also who the interviewees were, was going to then determine how we do the background. The goal was to get some sort of diversity, whether it was nation of origin, so where people's Sephardic roots hailed from. So we had Mexican representation, Venezuelan representation, Argentine representation, and then going back a generation, we had Turkish Sephardic, Syrian Sephardic, and Egyptian Sephardic. So we had good Sephardic and Latin American representation. There was gender representation that varied. So half the interviewees were male and half were female. There was generational diversity, and there was also diversity in terms of when people's families migrated to Latin America, and then when the interviewees themselves migrated from Latin America to the United States. So even within the six, you know, to get as well-rounded representation as we possibly could, we were able to hit that diversity, which I also wonder if that landed with students as well, because like you said, most of the students were of Latinx descent. And this was a Latinx history class. Some students, including you, were of Jewish descent. This was a Jewish history class. I would point out that every Jewish person in the room, including myself, was either Latinx or of mixed background. That was serendipitous too, but that was significant. So yeah, I guess my question for you is, you know, you spoke to both your personal connection to the class and your intellectual one. Can you talk about a little bit about your experience with the interviewee, but also how those personal and intellectual connections played out during the interview process? You know, we're ranging from preparing for the interview to actually conducting the interview.
Yeah, so I was in a two-person group. My partner actually hailed from Venezuela, so she herself was an immigrant from a Latin American country and came to the U.S. when she was in high school. We both spoke Spanish. She herself was a native speaker. I learned as a second language learner. And we had Dr. Lucy Grabard, and she was of Sephardic and Ashkenazi descent. She is from Mexico City, and she immigrated to the U.S. when she was younger. So she had a clear distinction between her life in Mexico City and then her life in the U.S., both as a Latinx identifier and as a Jewish identifier, and then as a person who was in that niche community. When I learned that she was from Mexico City, I was like, yes, because part of my family hails from Mexico, and that's always been a place that I wanted to go to explore family history. I used to go down to the Valley, which is South Texas, every summer, right? So there was this connection with that culture and that heritage. And so as we're preparing for the project, I have a partner who has firsthand experience coming from a Latin American country. My experience is of a person who felt distant to her, both her cultural backgrounds of her family, to the Jewish, because I didn't grow up in the Jewish neighborhood here in Houston, but also to the Hispanic, because I didn't speak Spanish until I learned it myself, right? And then we're talking to Dr. Lucy Grabard, who kind of is in the middle of those two types of things, because she was new to the U.S. as a child. And she told us, wow, you know, I couldn't speak English when I started going to school. I had to work my butt off to be able to even be functional in the class. And they didn't really, they provided resources for her, but she really had to learn to assimilate on her own. As we're going through, I learn about the differences in the Jewish communities between Mexico City and then the U.S. Jewish community, and the similarity as well. And it's literally watching history be like being told to me instead of having to read it or analyze it or in a video. It's that's the beauty about an oral history. And you didn't have us just jump into it. Like, we had to prepare. You had us read a book about how to do oral history interviews. You had us discuss in class some preparation questions. You had us practice on our partners, you know, these questions, and you had us practicing listening skills and definitely the credibility of, because we want to be credible as people who are doing the interview, because we want to make sure that we're letting the interviewee really have the spotlight, because that's why we're doing what we're doing. And you having previous knowledge of doing public history, especially in the Jewish Latinx community, was very helpful, right? Because you helped, you had us listen to an interview that you did with a guy who immigrated, was it from Chile, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And then he went to Israel, he had some family in Israel too. I remember that, right? So we were listening to that. Personally, I was amazed. I felt like I stepped through a door and the things I knew about both the Latinx and the Jewish community had expanded amazingly. And then as a person who loves history, I was amazed by this new form of history, this new method in which history could be collected and available to people. And it could just be, it could be uploaded to a digital archive and the public could have access to it. Like, the fact that you told us that that was going to be possible at the end of this project was like, oh my God, we can just like see our videos on the internet. That's so cool. And researchers can use it in the future, people, if they just want to see it. So I really grew a lot from this experience and I learned a lot. I did a research poster for the first time. I had no idea what that was. And it was, I thought it was going to be one of those trifolds I made in like elementary school or middle school. And it was like, no, there is a way to do it. And so at the same time, I was learning the skills to really continue on my way to be a graduate student. So the fact that you offer this possibility to undergraduate students allows for people like me to get the experience of doing research and of practicing history in a certain, using a certain method, and try and really figuring out if it's something that I want to continue doing. Do I like this? Instead of going to grad school and being like, oh, okay, now is the time I'm going to experience research. I think this not only was just an informational educational class, which is, you know, and it's fun. We get to do it with a local institution, but it's really important as a unique experience for an undergraduate student when classes like this are not always offered or funded. So it was just a really unique experience.
I have to ask a question about the practicing of the interviews, because I'm relatively new to oral history myself. Like, I was trained as a colonial historian, so I wasn't dealing with living subjects. When I knew I was going to be researching Jewish Latinos in the 20th century, I went to the Voces Oral History Project. at UT Austin offers like what we called an oral history boot camp to learn how to do this. And that was only, 2014. So it's not that long ago. And the piece of this that when I started doing oral history till now that I find intimidating, and what I'd love to hear what you think about, is part of the significance and importance of this or any oral history project is the archiving component, right? Like you're creating a primary source that is going into an archive. The added importance here and why this project, the Sephardic Latinx Oral History Project, exists is because Jewish Latinx history is so hidden that there isn't really an archive. Okay, so you all were creating an archive that doesn't really exist anywhere, okay? And then, in the lead up to practicing the interviews, you're learning about that we're reading about and we're discussing oral history methodology and theory. And so, you're learning all this stuff. So put that together with the weight of the archive that in my experience, then once I got to the interview or like to prep for the interview, it was nerve-wracking because you're like, you've got to think about method and theory. And then you have this like weight of the archive. Oh, and then you got to be an active listener and all that, which is hard to do sometimes when you want to participate in the conversation. And I remember telling you all that, at the end of the day, this is a conversation. You're talking to another human being, which you do every day of your life. But then what I didn't say is at the same time, it's not a conversation because your point of view doesn't matter. Like the interviewees is the only one that does. So how was all of that in both the practicing, like how did all of that weigh on the practicing exercises and then the actual interview?
Oh, you're talking to someone who's, my mom would tell me that I would sit on the bleachers at my brother's baseball game and I turn around and start asking a person about their life. So you're talking to someone who's done it since I was a little kid, just naturally out of curiosity. So I don't know how I can speak for other students, but I do know that practicing with my partner was different for each of us because I definitely am not shy with asking questions in any really situation. I've never been shy about public speaking. I have a fear of tripping up or failing and something like that. So that was my fear, right? So I wanted to make sure it was perfect. I wanted not to interrupt her. Like I was like, do I ask the next question? Or like, what if I have a follow-up question? Like, should I put that follow-up question here or should I go to what's on the list? Like it was between finding that balance between following the outline and following the advice that we read in the book and that you gave us, but also being flexible at the same time because every interview is different and it calls for different things. So it was learning to trust myself that no matter how the interview came out, it was okay because I did my best and I put in the work and I practiced the skills that were, I felt important in the interview, like active listening. So to me, I made sure to concentrate on giving Dr. Gravard time to talk. We ended up having a pretty long interview because Dr. Gravard, who you told us, it's going to take a little bit for her to probably warm up to us. And that happens to a lot of interviewees. Like you warned us about that. Like it's great to go in and just get to know your interviewee before you even do the interview, right? So have a conversation with them before you even have the formal conversation with them. Like let them get to know you and just like human to human, have that interaction. And we did that with Dr. Gabbard and we met her at her house. And we sat down and she served us some of the food that I think it was from where her ancestors were from before Mexico City. I forgot exactly what they were.
I thought she gave you borecas, did she?
Borecas, yes.
They're savory pastries. And well, borequitas are the small ones and borecas are like empanada size. And they're dough pastries filled with usually either cheese and or potato. Mm-hmm. And it's a Sephardic food. I mean, the people who I know who make them have roots in like Greece, Turkey, and Syria.
Thank you. So she gave us a Sephardic food, which is even better because Sephardic Latinx History Project, hello. So she shared something with us. And I started asking the questions, and then she started just talking more and giving us more information. And it was just like, whoa, I just fell into the experience. And I didn't forget what you told us, but to be honest, it became natural to want to sit and listen. It became natural to want to weigh my questions and be like, okay, which one do I really want to know? Like, which one is most important right now? And I only have such little time with this person. Where do I need to go to make sure I get her full life story here? So that is how I experienced doing oral history for the first time as an undergraduate, both practicing and experiencing it for the first time.
You know, it's really hard to do what you said, which is to create a rapport with her that you all created, to be listening, and then in the moment to be, you know, looking at your script and like adjusting on the fly. It's tricky to do, and you all pulled it off. And I do want to say also, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I knew half the interviewees from childhood, including Dr. Grabard. And so I knew that she was shy. And I only met you that semester, but I knew you were outgoing. And I intentionally paired her with you, actually. And so I'm telling you this because I feel that as a listener of the interview, that it's clear that you all developed a rapport and that she was comfortable sharing her story with you, which is the goal. You know, I've definitely done oral histories where there's just a varying level of comfort between the interviewee and interviewer. And, you know, each experience is important and unique, and you get important stories no matter what. But of course, when the rapport is as strong as it was with you all, you feel it in the interview, and it just adds this level of documenting the history that you want to achieve. You know, that's at the core of oral history work. And I definitely heard it when I was listening to the interview. I mean, the fact that she you know, brought you in her house and like served you the bordecas highlights that too. But she really shared a lot. And the fact that you said the interview was longer than you expected, that also highlights the rapport. Maybe we should talk about the panel at the museum. There were two important teaching goals in this class. So one, like a key theme of Jewish Latinx history that has already come up a few times in this conversation, is that when you're talking about, to use your word earlier, this bicultural group, for the individuals in the community, including the interviewees, that these identities were entangled, right? Like they didn't exist, they don't and didn't exist separate from one another. To be Jewish informed the interviewees' experiences as being Latino and vice versa. To be Latinx informed their experiences as Jews. And so talking about this history with both identities, not only in focus, but as informing one another, was an important piece of the class, and highlighting that entanglement, it was an important piece of the interviewing. And then the other piece, of course, is that you're, you know, dealing with living subjects, you really see how this is living history. And that's a key piece of public history, right? That like history lives, it doesn't only exist in the past. And when you're dealing with living subjects, you, and interviewing them about their stories, like you feel that right away. And then there's the added layer of what it means to experience living history for a community whose history hasn't really even been recognized, or the community's existence hasn't even been recognized. So there's an added layer of the impact of the livingness of the history. And so creating the archive, of course, reflected those two goals, but it was important to present the archive to the community in a space within the community. And the Holocaust Museum, I should say, isn't a Jewish community space, but it has ties to the Jewish community, and it also has ties to the Latinx community. So holding a like archive release party in the museum really underlined these goals of recovering entangled histories and documenting living history. And so we formed a panel with three student interviewers and two interviewees, and then I moderated a conversation between them. So talk a little bit about that experience. What was it like to sit on that panel? And what was it like to talk about the project with both interviewees and general community members who, you know, are the main audience for this archive?
I mean, not even just sitting on the panel, just like being in, like having a public exhibition of our work was the start of it, right? So we walk into the, I brought my parents who, you know, as a couple kind of live through these two worlds. So my mom was fascinated. Like, you know, she's like, Mexico City and Argentina, and she's looking at all these research posters. And then my dad, it's so important to him, his Jewish heritage. So he loved this event. It mattered so much to him that the Holocaust Museum was honoring some part of Jewish history that he related to. And so the research posters were cool. I loved seeing every other student's research poster, and I got to really read the summary of what each of the interviewees' life was. And then obviously they added visuals. Some people added some timelines to get some ideas. It was really great. And then the panel started, and the two interviewees who were on the panel, they were talkative and I loved it. I got to hear so much, and they loved sharing really their perspective and their experience. And it went even beyond the research poster to me. And to me, that's an aspect of public history that you really brought to life. You made public history in that moment by helping create that panel, because there's living history in front of us. There's people talking about their lives with no expectations beyond that this is a celebration of their experience. There's people who go and speak and talk about their lives all the time, right? They're called motivational speakers or life coaches or TED Talks. And that's great, but it's maybe about one part of their life, or they're there to motivate you with life stories, and then they'll talk about a greater thing. This was just truly celebrating the history of these people's experiences and relating their experiences into a category, as you said, that's really lost history or not really studied yet, which is Latinx Jewish history. And I loved listening to them. And then hearing my fellow students talk was really cool, because they had different experiences talking to their people. Their people were from different countries. They had different backgrounds, different histories. They came to the U.S. at different ages, different decades. And so they got to talk about their experience. And maybe they didn't relate to the ethnic and racial identification of the group that we were studying and researching, but they felt some sort of connection. So they came from a more distant perspective. Like, I've been immersed in it since I was little, and I loved hearing that they loved doing this project. They really enjoyed speaking to these people. And I felt that they also appreciated the importance of doing oral history. I mean, history itself, but the practice of oral history and the importance of it. And also the Holocaust Museum, like, I think a lot of people don't know that museums have, like, the Holocaust Museum has its own library, and museums do hold archives, not only libraries. And I know academics know this, but for the public to know this, like, I think that's another part of public history is people are working on that, is to make archives more accessible to the public. And the Holocaust Museum was literally doing that with us. So they were step by step with us. Public history to me made a big impact. I've been around history my entire life, but just as I was living history, I was able to hear living history while interviewing Dr. Lucy Grabard. I felt like I was living public history while we were doing the panel. It's kind of like when someone finishes their project and they're like, wow, like, I get to see the impact of my work on, if it's one life or 10 lives or millions of lives with the connections that we have these days. I love seeing the interest in other people on work, and it's just, so I think that's why I love history and I love education.
Yeah, you know, there's something impactful about oral history, either doing it or listening to an interview that lands in a different way compared to a written document. I mean, I'm a history nerd, so I love all types of sources. But my reading of the audience was the same as yours, that I could see that they felt the impact of the project. And I do want to say, like you're saying, the panel really highlighted the power of oral history and public history. Like you and your classmates and the two interviewees described the value of the project, and then the audience felt it. And so it was important to have that event for that reason, I would say. The other thing I think is important about what you said is how you mentioned how the Holocaust Museum, like other museums, have an archive, and they now have a digital oral history archive. And that was another important piece of this that I didn't mention, which is those interviews theoretically could have gone somewhere else, right? For example, they could have gone to a university archive. But I think there's important questions about how accessible are university archives, especially digital ones, to non-academics of different generations. And the fact that the museum, which is a premier cultural institution in the city, which has reach beyond the city, state, and country, are created and hosting this archive and going to the Sephardic Latinx Oral History Project website is just a more seamless, accessible, streamlined experience compared to navigating an oral history project at a university archive, at least in my experience. And so that was another piece of this, is housing it at the museum archive connects with the accessibility questions around public history and the desire to open up access as much as possible. And one thing I should also say related to this that I don't think I've told you is that I've been asked to present on the project in the community multiple times. And one of the times was at the museum. So the museum every 2 years hosts what's called the Silverman Institute, which is for educators in the United States and Latin America who teach on primarily the Holocaust, but also genocide and also Jewish and or Latin American history. And so I presented on the project and I presented on Jewish Latin American history in general. And so we had this great conversation about how to use the interviews, for example, as a teaching source. And so then the idea was that these instructors across the hemisphere would then, you know, take that home and use them. And the museum has told me that dozens of people have already been watching these interviews. And so I don't know if they've been able to track from where, but based on the fact that this was part of their Silverman Institute, I think it's safe to assume that the reach, again, is hemispheric, at least. So yeah, I think that the impact is really there. And a big reason has to do, of course, with the easy access of, you know, listening to these interviews or watching them, because actually they were video recorded on the museum's website.
That's what I also love about oral history, is it can be visual or not. It could just have audio. But the fact that it's audio gives it so much more dimension. It's like when the radio was invented and then the TV was invented. If it has video, we can see their facial expression. Yeah. We can look around wherever they are. We can see their body. Like maybe they're nervous and their shoulders. Like it's so much more analyzation and so much more that people can see into that personal history of that person. Like they can just even get to know that person even more because they can analyze the history even more on such a personal level. And that's what I loved about saying, like, Lucy opened up more. And we know that because her tone of voice got louder. She started talking more and her shoulders became less stiff. And then you could tell, like, what part she kind of got more emotional at by the tone of her voice. And, like, that's just something in writing that can not always be portrayed.
Right. Like, the transcripts are there for accessibility purposes, but you're right. Like, people make meaning in their movements. And so you can see how they're telling the story too, not just what they're saying, but how they're saying it. And that adds a layer of impact as well. So the project idea from the beginning is that it doesn't end here. It's unfinished. And I know that you want to roll with it, as they say. Yeah. So can you talk about that? Like, how are you going to build on what you started?
Well, I was wanting to focus on the Latinx population in the U.S. And so I want to continue to work with the Latinx Initiative at the Holocaust Museum to present a available product of public history that I hope will be able to be available to the public at the end of my master's degree, which goes along with a thesis that connects the Jewish dialogue, the Jewish history, the Jewish experience with the Hispanic experience. Because I feel like I bring both a personal and a skill developed perspective, as you know, because being a history major, doing a lot of undergraduate research, doing co-curricular activities like this, I feel like has prepared me to be able to take on the weight and the importance of telling these untold stories, because there's really, as you said, there's not an archive for it. So there's really no precedence before me saying, you know, this is the most popular perspective of presenting this historical information. There's a hole here. There's just a big hole in general. So to be able to even consider on what avenue and what focus I want to take is really exciting to me. It's an unfinished project. It will be unfinished when I'm done with my project, probably anyways. But I wanted to ask you, Dr. Goldberg, you know, these are untold stories. And you said, I know you yourself, your family comes from Mexico. Seeing students that you helped to bring this experience to us, seeing this plan really come to life and be implemented, and now seeing the wonderful impacts of such a project like this. And like now one of your students, like me, wants to, you know, continue to do something, which, you know, this project really inspired me to continue to do something like it. What does it mean to you to see that, to experience that?
Yeah, I mean, well, as an instructor, educator, it's the best. But I felt that in the semester. Like, I didn't know going in how it was going to go. It's when you're working with community partners too, it's like there's a lot of unpredictability, and you always hope that people are interested in the subject matter. I was confident the students would be, because I've been teaching here long enough to know how strong the students are. But I also knew that students didn't know they were signing up for an oral history class. And then, like, the moment that was the best that semester was at the panel, where I really, like I said, when I heard you and your classmates describe the value of the project, it was, as an educator and public historian, just amazing to hear. As a Jewish Latinx community member, as a researcher focused on this history, like, I'm personally and intellectually invested in it. And so my goal when I created the class was to make clear that this is a Latinx history class and this is a Jewish history class. It's not one or the other. It's both. It's a U.S. history class. It's a Latin American history class. And so inserting, or not just inserting, but making clear that this Latinx Jewish story has something to tell us about the past. And yeah, then as like a community member, I've always grappled with, well, being an in-betweener. I haven't grappled with it because it's normal to me, but like, I guess the responses to this in-betweenness has been something to grapple with, right? Like, where do you belong? And how do people who don't know this community exists understand? And so to be able to highlight that experience or place it at the center of a study of the past, and also to document that experience is, from a personal level, just huge. Well, I know that part of the audience that day was from the Jewish Latinx community, and I think that was part of the response was being seen, right? Like recognizing that your history is significant. And one experience I've had that's related, I should mention, is when I was doing my research and I thought there'd be a Houston component, I had a meeting with one of the founding board members of Hebraica Houston, which in the 80s and 90s was the Latin American Jewish social organization. And he had like a small accordion folder of documents from his time as president of Hebraica. And he's the only one who really kept anything. And one thing that was jarring is like, I don't know if this is true, but I felt that there were hundreds of people in this group. And if he's the only one that kept stuff, that suggests that most people didn't necessarily feel, not that that the material wasn't worth keeping, but that it had archival value. And I believe that that comes with being told that your history doesn't matter. And there are ways that people convey to other people that their history doesn't matter. And in this case, one of them is to not recognize that this community exists and has a history. And so to be able to redress that by creating an archive, or really directing students to create an archive, is so important for that reason, for the community. And that's also, again, like one of the significant components of public history and why working with communities and doing history with communities matters and is different than if I were to lock myself in a library and, you know, use written sources and write a history of Jewish Latinos. Like, that's different. And in my opinion, less impactful, because it doesn't reflect the community's own sense of self and their needs. And so that really also like speaks to why the archive, why there's power in building an archive. And it really revolves around the community.
So Dr. Goldberg, where can people go to find information on the project that we did with the Holocaust Museum of Houston?
Yeah, so the Sephardic Latinx Oral History Project is housed on the Holocaust Museum Houston's website. And the best way to get there is to go to hmh.org, specifically to link to Latinx initiatives, which we talked a little bit about. And there you'll find the Sephardic Latinx Oral History Project webpage, which is the archive of the oral histories that the students conducted, including both videos and transcripts. Miranda, I want to thank you for your time, and it was wonderful to talk to you about the project and, of course, to hear from the student side of things what you got out of it. So thanks for participating in this conversation.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg, for really helping me get started on my public history journey. This project has made a big difference in my life, and I loved being a part of it, and I loved being able to talk to you about it more than a year later and reflecting on what it's grown into and the possibilities of it.
I should also say I'm excited to see where you take it.
Yes, you happen to be my advisor. Dr. Goldberg happens to be my advisor for my MA, so I get to continue to work with you on these untold stories.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Public Historians at Work. You can show your support for this podcast and the Center for Public History through a donation at giving.uh.edu/public-history. For more information about the diverse work of the Center for Public History, find us online at uh.edu/class/CPH or through social media at UHCP History. Remember, we are all keepers of our history.